A friendship with a fox.
I would say that the fox tamed me. He dogged me around. He knew instinctively that friendship was important, and he knew I was the most important big mammal around, and he was determined to be my friend.
That's Catherine Raven. We talk with her about her best-selling memoir, Fox and I, An Uncommon Friendship. But first, recycling maven Jenny Romer tells us all about making the right recycling choices. Her book is Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single-Use Plastics. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Have you ever stood in front of a recycling bin holding an everyday object and wondered, can I recycle this? I'll bet you have, lots of times. Have you ever just tossed it in, not knowing the answer? That's not recycling, that's wish-cycling. But help is on the way. In her illustrated book, Can I Recycle This?, Jenny Romer takes readers on a quick but informative tour of how recycling actually works, and she gives straightforward answers to whether dozens of common household objects can or cannot be recycled. Jenny Romer is a legal associate for the Surfrider Foundation's Plastic Pollution Initiative. She helped author plastic bag bans in California and New York. Can I Recycle This? Was illustrated by Christy Young. Well, Jenny Romer, welcome to Writer's Voice. So this book, in the first pages, I was surprised to find that you have some typical questions that are asked, and they're exactly the same questions I'm always asking myself. Things like, can I recycle the netted bag my clementines come in? I just asked that to myself yesterday, as a matter of fact. What happens to the plastic bags I bring back to the grocery store to recycle? So, but before we get to the answers of those questions, first, just tell us about your work as a lawyer and a sustainability consultant who works for effective legislation on waste reduction and single-use plastics. Tell us just a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I think I'm known mostly for my work on plastic bags. So I'm one of the national experts on plastic bag policy. I started that when I was a law student in San Francisco. I volunteered with the Board of Supervisors when the initial plastic bag law was being implemented in San Francisco, and really got to know kind of the ins and outs and saw that the plastics industry was willing to spend a whole lot of money. So I saw a presentation that said they were willing to spend $700,000 in just a few months to fight local plastics policies. And I thought, this is a big deal. So I started a website about that, plasticbaglaws.org, kind of positioned myself as an expert. And now I'm a legal associate with the Surfrider Foundation's Plastic Pollution Initiative. And I spend pretty much all of my time working on laws to reduce single-use plastics. And there's a lot of overlap with recycling with that. I go to a lot of recycling conferences and go on tours. And so I've learned a whole lot about recycling along the way. And I decided to move forward with this book, really focused first on recycling, because that's what a whole lot of people kind of take pride in their recycling. And then ultimately concentrating on reducing single-use plastic and passing policies to ensure that it's reduced.
And it's a really great read. I mean, I read the whole book in about 2 hours. It's got lots of great illustrations. It's very well laid out. First, tell us, you know, reduce, reuse, recycle. That's the mantra of recycling. But tell us, what does it really mean? What does recycling mean? And I heard once that there was a kind of pyramid with reduce, reuse, recycle. So talk about that mantra and what recycling is.
Yeah, so the reduce, reuse, recycle mantra has been around since the 70s. And really the things that we should be concentrating on the most are supposed to be in that order. So reduction, reuse, and then recycling. But there's been a whole lot of marketing about recycling. And so it's very intentional that so many of us really think of recycling as the best thing that we can do to have a positive impact or have less of an impact on the environment. The plastics industry spent a lot of money in the late 80s, early 90s on marketing plastic as recyclable, in part because they saw that there were some laws that were pending, some local laws that were pending targeted at reducing plastic use. And so they thought, oh, if we spend a lot of money on marketing and make people feel better about using plastic, it won't be regulated as much. And so that worked. And plastic packaging has not been very regulated until very recently.
Plastic bags, you mean?
Plastic bags and plastics in general. So it started with plastic bags, really. Like I said, San Francisco was kind of at the forefront of that. They were the first city to pass and implement a ban or regulation on single-use plastic carry-out bags. And now there are over 550 local jurisdictions and 9 states that have plastic bag laws in effect. I see that as kind of a gateway to reduction of other plastics. So, once people are getting comfortable with that, we've also seen laws regulating or banning foam foodware, people call styrofoam foodware, on straws. And now we're seeing other types of utensils regulated. And then what I work on more and more now is regulations of all that other stuff that's on the grocery store shelves. So the bread bags and the hummus containers and all that other packaging.
Well, here, it's funny. You mentioned in the book, Suffolk County, New York, which is where I live, that in 1988, it adopted a ban on plastic grocery bags and other plastic food containers, got sued. That failed, that legislation, I guess, or was undone. Recently, a couple of years ago, we passed a plastic grocery bag ban. It's going very well. In my hometown in East Hampton, we banned plastic straws, and other towns around us have followed, and it may even be on the Suffolk County level. So it takes a long time, 1988, over 40, is that 30 years that it took to finally get that to happen. Do you feel that this is a movement that is strengthening?
Yeah, and I appreciate that you brought up the Suffolk County example. I think, that was one of the places that was moving forward back in the late 80s. And then the plastics industry really came in with all of their marketing, introducing the requirements for and lobbying for the requirements to have that little chasing arrow symbol on containers. And that really is just meant as a resin identification code. It tells you what type of plastic that container is made out of, but people see it and think, oh, it's recyclable, and feel kind of more comfortable using some of the plastics because they think that they're recyclable. So I think, it started back then in the late 80s, or maybe a little bit before then. And then we saw that pushback from the plastics industry. We saw kind of Keep America Beautiful campaign that kind of put the onus on individuals to, pick up their litter and stuff and focus on that as the problem. But then in the early 2000s, we started seeing places moving forward again and saying, wait, no, we should be regulating single-use plastic. And then San Francisco adopted their law and there was a kind of a trickle. But now we're at a point where they're becoming so much more common regulating all those things. And so it's really part of there's momentum to have a conversation about other types of things that are on the grocery store shelves. And so now we're seeing a lot of states introducing legislation called extended producer responsibility, or EPR, which is kind of a wonky term, but it's really regulating, having the manufacturers be financially responsible for all the recycling and waste disposal of all of that packaging, and then making them really encouraging them to make products, make packaging that's more recyclable in the first place, that's made out of material that's recyclable. And so, you know, I think that all that momentum that started, you know, back in Suffolk County back then is, you know, that was still part of the story that's happening now. We've just kind of have a lot more momentum going now.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jenny Romer about Can I Recycle This? It's her guide to better recycling and how to reduce single-use plastics. So, you know, I think, as you mentioned, people look at that little, you know, recycle icon and they don't really think about the number that's in the middle of it. They just assume, oh, this is recyclable. You know, you point out that only 9% of the plastic ever produced has been recycled. That is basically way cheaper to just use virgin plastic instead of to recycle it. So give us a state now. And I also know that, by the way, that China, you know, we were blithely sending all our crap to China for decades, but that's greatly reduced. So give us a sense of the state of the recycling industry now.
Yeah, I like how you said crap. We were sending a lot of our low value stuff, our plastics to China, and they stopped taking it. So I think that really shifted the conversation too back in 2018, because it was easy to, you know, sell the low value plastic, have it go abroad. It was processed in a lot of places where there were a lot of environmental and humanitarian concerns there with family farms that were kind of converted to recycling facilities that were not regulated. And so, you know, people without the proper gear that were burning plastic in their backyards and dumping it. So was very happy to see that go into effect and to really have a conversation in the US more about what we're doing with our plastics. And so I think that really opened the door to all of the policies that we're seeing now, because if we were continuing to ship it abroad and have it go away to the extent that we were before, then we wouldn't be talking about policy at all, I think.
And tell us about wish cycling. This seems very familiar to me because, you know, we have what's called a transfer station here. You know, it's the recycling center, basically. And I'm very familiar with wish cycling. I try very hard not to do it, but it's a process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's certain things. So wish cycling is when you're putting something in your recycling bin that your jurisdiction doesn't want. And you either, you know, aren't paying enough attention to the rules, or you are just thinking that they should take it and thinking that if you just put it in the bin that they'll kind of figure it out. And so I think people have kind of, some people think of their recycling facilities maybe as a place where they're taking the material and you know, making new materials right there, right near there. That's not the case. The plastics recycling is a commodities market. And so, you know, things don't get made into something else unless they're sorted and baled and then sold to a manufacturer. And so your jurisdiction has made up their mind about what they can accept based on what facilities they have for sorting and who they know their buyers are. So my biggest take home is to, you know, follow your local rules. But if some people, you know, if your local jurisdiction doesn't accept yogurt cups and people still really want to, you know, eat their yogurt and they want to think they're recycling it and they put it in their bin, that's not good for the facility because that just means they're having, if they know that they aren't going to find a buyer for it, that's going to be a kind of more, just a more roundabout way of to a landfill, unfortunately. But there are some things that are worse to wish cycle that actually cause a lot of havoc at recycling facilities. So things like plastic bags tend to gum up the facilities or long things like hoses or extension cords. Those are called tanglers. They cause a lot of problems. or batteries, especially reusable batteries, can cause fires and explosions.
Right. And yes, I am guilty of recycling yogurt containers, although not in the last year or so.
It's hard because I think people really think, oh, but you know, maybe if I put it in, they'll just figure it out. But, you know, your facility, you know, they know what buyers they have. So make sure you follow your rules. And I will say that the most valuable plastics on the market now have been pretty consistently are number one and number two bottles and jugs. So those tend to be like water bottles, milk, plastic milk jugs, shampoo bottles. And those are materials that have a value on the commodities market. And the yogurt cups have a lower value, unfortunately. And there aren't really enough places in the U.S. that want to recycle them.
But there's a trick to even some of those number one and number two plastics, because, you know, there's an issue with sleeves, the sleeves on bottles. Talk about that.
Oh, yeah. So the number one and number two bottles and jugs are the most recyclable, but they still could have some issues. So sleeves, and I've seen more and more of this, unfortunately. So the kind of plastic sleeves that some companies, or a lot of the time you'll see some kind of sleeve on your bottle that has the brand name on it, some other information. But we're seeing more and more bottles that have a sleeve over kind of the whole bottle. And if you have a big sleeve on the bottle, then the machinery at facilities they have cameras that will I like to think of them as lasers, but they're cameras that will read what type of resin the bottle's made out of and kind of sort it into the right bin with air guns. But if there's a big sleeve in the way, it can't tell what type of resin it's made out of, and it'll just end up sending it to a landfill or incineration. So, you know, that's one thing where I say, you know, if you can, you know, avoid buying bottles that have, you know, try to avoid buying plastic bottles if you can, even avoid buying bottles with big sleeves even more. And then if you do get them, try to, you know, take off the sleeves before putting them in the recycling bin.
Yeah, you have a lot of really great tips. And I learned a lot of things here. One of them is that size matters. You know, it's not just what the item is composed of, but for example, bottles and tops. Talk about that.
Yeah. So plastic water bottles, like you said, are more recyclable. They have an end market. But those caps are generally too small to make it through recycling machinery on their own. So, you know, when I get into the debate of should you put the cap on or not, and the answer is yes, you should leave your cap on the bottle. And because by on their own, they'd fall through the machinery, and caps, we see a lot of them at beach cleanups. I work for the Surfrider Foundation. We do a lot of beach cleanups. We see a lot of bottle caps, in part because they float. But the floating actually helps in the recycling sorting system. So once a manufacturer buys those bottles, they shred the whole bale of bottles. And then those caps are made out of number five. And the caps will float to the surface of the water after it's shredded. And the bottles are made out of PET, and they'll sink to the bottom of the water. And so they're able on the other end to kind of sort out the bottles, the caps from the bottles. But definitely put your cap on when you put it into your bin.
So what about glass bottles and their caps?
I would take those caps off, especially if they tend to be metal caps on glass bottles. And so metal, that can be sorted a little bit easier at facilities because they use magnets. And so if you take the cap off of a glass container, it still might fall through some cracks somewhere, but it still has some likelihood of making it to a bale of metal to then be recycled.
Now, there's a whole lot of stuff that, you know, you go to Whole Foods and it says, oh, this, you know, this silverware is compostable. I mean, we know that plastic forks and other silverware of the garden variety type is not recyclable. But what about all those supposedly recyclable silverware and other items?
The ones that are marketed as compostable, I still see as very problematic. There was a letter from Oregon Composters that said, you know, we don't want your compostable foodware. And so I think it's something where I personally, you know, Surfrider doesn't have a stance on it, but I personally don't support compostable and biodegradable plastics. And there's so many proprietary chemicals that are in there that I don't really want to have in the soil. I really want to concentrate on reuse as much as we can. So, you know, I mentioned in the book that I try to bring my own utensils everywhere. And, you know, some can sometimes annoy restaurants and things. But if I know that I'm going somewhere that might have be using single-use plastic utensils, I'll bring my own from home. And also, you know, reusable food or bringing reusable containers to get takeaway food, because I want to avoid those single-use plastics as much as possible, including the compostable ones. But I will say that, you know, there is a lot of innovation happening. There are a lot of companies that are looking at creating biodegradable and compostable plastics. And, you know, maybe there will be something in the future. But right now, I haven't seen it yet.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and we're talking about recycling with Jenny Romer. Her book is Can I Recycle This? It's a guide to better recycling and how to reduce single-use plastics. Now, it's not just plastic. You know, I was very happy to find out in reading this book that aluminum foil is recyclable. I didn't know that, but you have to process it a little bit. You have to clean it, right? And then what else?
Yeah, and so that's one of the things that it's recyclable, but if you're just putting little bits of aluminum foil in your bin, it's less likely to get to make it through the recycling system and get sorted properly. But you can kind of, size matters again here too. So if you put your aluminum foil with, kind of scrunch it up with other aluminum foil and make it into a big ball before you put it into your recycling bin, then it's more likely to get sorted out by the machinery and actually sold and turned into a new item. Because aluminum itself is valuable, but the little bits are hard to capture.
So, and food composting, what about that? We don't really have that here where I live, but New York City has been, you know, it seems like forever. I remember in 2013, there was a big fanfare. They were doing a pilot program. And then that pilot program went away. And now maybe it's back, but it's still just a pilot program. What's the deal?
Yeah, so I'm based in New York City. And so I've been involved with some of that. And, you know, food scrap composting is complicated. And we have to have a lot of different moving parts that are working correctly. We've seen that it works pretty well on like a community composting scale of people bringing their scraps to particular gardens and things. But with the city's rollout, it rolled out as a pilot program. It went kind of to a wider pilot program. My neighborhood was never covered, unfortunately. But the participation rates weren't very high. I think there needed to be more outreach about using the bins and things like that. And then with COVID, there were a lot of cuts to the sanitation's budget, and composting was a huge cut. The cut not just the curbside programs, but a lot of the drop-off programs as well. So there was a huge push from the environmental community in New York City to get those programs happening again. And now there's going to be another pilot program that's happening. And so, you know, I'm from San Francisco originally, and composting, you know, San Francisco is a much smaller city, and we've been doing composting curbside there for a long time. And it's working well, but it's a lot to roll out in New York City. But I'm happy to see that at least we're starting again.
Well, that is good. So let's get to some more of the solutions. And, you know, this is happening, as we spoke before, a movement to ban plastics. People are very worried about ocean plastic pollution, which is, you know, you liken it to smog. These are, you know, the plastic breaks down into tiny little microscopic particles where it just, you know, goes into our food supply and upsets the ecosystem of the entire ocean. But, you know, as fossil fuel use for power is decreasing, the fossil fuel industry is ramping up its efforts to plasticize everything. You say that global plastic production is expected to quadruple by 2050. I mean, this is a catastrophe, you know, really possibly on the order of the climate catastrophe as well. So what should be done?
Yeah, and I will say that 11 million metric tons of plastic are entering our ocean now. And if we don't change something, that also by 2050, we'll have more plastic by weight in the ocean than fish. So it's a big deal. And so I work, you know, I'm a legal associate for the Surfrider Foundation's Plastic Pollution Initiative. And so I look at this policies from the lens of protecting the ocean in particular. And, you know, a lot of what we've been saying, I think, concentrating on reducing single-use plastics in the first place and not just recycling is a big take home. But, and I think my book goes through a lot of what's happening with single-use plastic recycling now and how a lot of it isn't working. So reducing first, and then also fixing the recycling infrastructure and what things are made of. So making sure that packaging is recyclable in the first place.
And there's an initiative you talk about in the book, and I've heard about this also, the Break Free from Plastics Act, BFFPP Act. What is this act? Where is it now? Has it been introduced? You know, we've got the filibuster, which is really got to go, or I'm not sure we're going to have a democracy, much less be able to deal with plastics pollution. But talk about the fight that's happening right now, and then tell us what people can do to support it.
Sure. Yeah. So the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act was introduced back in 2020 by Senator Udall and Congressmember Lowenthal. I actually introduced some staffers in their offices. And so I've been involved since the beginning and in you know, working on this legislation. And it really covers the whole life cycle of plastics. So it has regulations for plastic production facilities to make sure that we're not adding more until we make sure we really need them. It has the plastic bag laws and straws upon request policies. So all those little items that we've already been talking about at the local and state level and kind of know how to address. It has extended producer responsibility. So corporations are paying for the cost of recycling and waste disposal of their packaging. It bans shipment of low-value plastic waste to developing countries. And so I think it really looks holistically at the plastics issue. And it's at the federal level. It was reintroduced this year with Senator Merkley from Oregon as the new sponsor on the Senate side. And, you know, with the filibuster, I think there's a lot of other things happening in the Senate right now with HR1. But it's really sparked a lot of conversations. I think we will see it moving forward more soon, it also includes a national bottle bill. But it's also sparked a lot of conversation at the state level, where we've seen 10 states introduce bills talking about EPR for packaging. And we're seeing companies also talking about it more. Last year, when it was introduced, there weren't many companies that were supportive, but now we're seeing more companies coming to the table and talking about it. So I think we're making some progress, but we really need to pick up the pace, and we need to make a lot more progress soon in order to really reduce all the plastic that we're using.
Well, this is just a terrific book. Can I Recycle This? Jenny Roemer, it's been great to talk with you. At our website, we will provide links to the campaigns and to resources that you list in the book. And all I can say is thanks so much for doing this work and for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much. I'm happy that you enjoyed the book.
Next up, an uncommon friendship with a fox. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Catherine Raven finished her PhD in biology, she built herself a tiny cottage on an isolated plot of land in Montana. She was as emotionally isolated as she was physically, but she viewed the house as a way station, a temporary rest stop, where she could gather her nerves and fill out applications for what she hoped would be a real job that would help her fit into society. Then one day she realized that a fox was showing up on her property every afternoon at 4:15 p.m. She'd never had a regular visitor before. How do you even talk to a fox? She brought out her camping chair, sat as close to him as she dared, and began reading to him from The Little Prince. Her scientific training had taught her not to anthropomorphize animals, but as she grew to know him, Fox's personality revealed itself, and they became friends. Raven's first job close to wildlife was as a ranger in Glacier National Park. There, she first confronted the ethical dilemma. Do we let wild animals suffer a, quote, natural fate? Or do we have the obligation to help them?
Yes, it was a moral dilemma. And I'm not sure I tried to handle it as best I could. But it haunted me and it tainted my relationship with everything, including my decision on what to do for a career. It was really something that pushed me towards getting a doctorate and trying to find out what in the world science is up to. And I didn't realize at the time that science isn't up to morals. Science is there to get us the information that we need. But what we do with that information, that's not something that science is there to help us with. And you're correct as far as how you identified the crux of that question. The moral dilemma is, what is our responsibility? Are we supposed to be patronizing them? Are we in charge of all the other beasts on the planet? Are they our neighbors? Are they our friends? Are they more like us than we realize, and then more likely to need the same kind of care and support that we give to fellow humans? And of course, the animal kingdom is enormous, so we don't treat every species in the animal kingdom alike. But the moral dilemma is, how do we treat our fellow animals? And I witnessed what I thought was an incorrect assessment at that time. I still don't think we have it right, and that is that it's okay for us to mistreat animals because they're natural. And it's natural for things to die and be tortured and have a horrible life and not give them medicines for diseases that they have because it's natural. That issue comes up again and again in the book. And I invite readers to think about it themselves. And I invite readers and give readers permission to use science, or we can't ever discount science, but to have permission to also use their instincts, their human nature, to help them get through the moral dilemmas.
And it was one in which you had to let a fawn die. You could not come to the aid of a fawn because it was against the rules of science to interfere with nature. And that was the profound moral dilemma.
But that's not science. That was policy. What I want to make sure that everybody hears, and also you'll read about it when you pick up Fox and I, the difference between science and a paradigm. And there's a pretty big difference, and it can be confusing. But one way that you understand it from this book is this moral dilemma that we've been talking about. In the moral dilemma that I faced, science wasn't really involved. Science isn't telling people that animals should die because natural deaths are good for wildlife. That's just a paradigm. And a paradigm is something that we just really don't know where it comes from. We know all about where science comes from. That's why we follow science, because it's got such a beautiful construction to it. Science sheds this incredibly bright light it sheds a narrow, I mean, it's a narrow, narrow, narrow beam. Science, as we said, can't tell us what to do when there's a moral dilemma. It can't tell us about things like love or God. So there's so many things in the world that science can't tell us about. But what science can tell us about, it's terrific and important and very, very clear. But science can't tell us something like, is it okay to let a wild animal die because death is good, because it's natural? That's not even a moral or an ethical issue. It's just a social issue. It's really just a paradigm. It's what society feels like should be done at a certain time.
Point well taken, but the science did become an issue with you as you entered into this relationship with the fox. So let's just go into that right now. This relationship, it all started with a double rainbow.
Yes, it started with the double rainbow because I was struggling with the idea of how much emotion I wanted to invest in an animal with such a short lifespan. It seemed insane to me. I could feel myself being drawn to him. This animal was very charismatic and he was luring me, but I didn't want to engage. I wanted to keep my distance, stay objective, not only because I wanted to follow what I thought were the basic principles of science and also my culture, which is that you just don't invite foxes into your social circle. But I realized while I was jogging and watching these rainbows, first one and then a second one, the rainbows are not uncommon, I should add that. Rainbows are common where I live. And every time I see them, and I think I've seen hundreds, I always stop, even if they're not double rainbows. But I can usually see both ends hitting the ground to give you an idea of how spectacular it is in this country where I live. So I can see both ends of the rainbow and sometimes both ends of a double rainbow, and they don't last very long. They're so fleeting. These are just ephemeral phenomenon, as you know, but they still stop me in my tracks. And sometimes when you're driving through the valley, you see other cars stopped on the side of the road and you realize everybody stopped looking at the rainbows. And these are local people who live here watching the same rainbows over and over hundreds of times. And I realize that longevity doesn't really have anything to do with the value, the intrinsic value of something. Rainbows are valued even though they might last a minute or two or less. And so there was no reason why I should not value a fox simply because I was going to invest a tremendous part of me in an animal that probably wouldn't live more than 4 years.
You call the relationship a friendship. What defines that friendship that you had with this fox?
The first thing is that it's willing. That's very important, that two individuals are on equal footing. So people might refer to a friendship with a professor or a boss. People use that word carefully and they realize it's not exactly the right description if you're talking about the relationship between a worker and a supervisor, because that's not really an equal relationship where people are both willing partners. And it's also not the same as a relationship of a pet with an owner. So there have to be people on equal footing. The fox and I were individuals who were completely independent. The fox was as independent from me as any human being could be from me. We were just two individuals. He didn't depend on me for food, for example. And of course, we get a lot of benefits from our friends, but we also have responsibilities if we're going to be friends. I think that that is the independent living, the independent choice, and the free choice. That's what's important in friendship. And friendship is the basic unit of fellowship. And that's something that's really important in the book, because really there's only two different social groups that anybody in this world can belong to. One of those groups is a family. That's the group that you're trapped in or stuck in, the group that you're given, the group that you have no options. That's what you're born into. So you have a family. And the only other group is a fellowship. So you have either a family or a fellowship or both. But those are the two types of social constructs. And friendship is the basic unit of a fellowship. On my land, the fox and I were friends, and there were lots of groups of friends on my land. Fox was friends with the magpies, a couple of magpies. all of these series of friendships come together to make up a fellowship. And those are big, big themes in The Fox and I.
So much to pick up there. And I will get back to some of those points, but now more about the fox, how this friendship unfolded. You would read The Little Prince to the fox, and there is a fox in The Little Prince, and The Little Prince talks about how to, quote, tame a fox, but it's not really about taming a fox because it is more of a friendship. In fact, the fox is the one who tells the little prince how to tame him. So that expresses that relationship. And you just used the word lure. In some ways, could you say that your fox tamed you?
Yes, I would say that the fox tamed me. He dogged me around. He knew instinctively that friendship was important, and he knew I was the most important big mammal around, and he was determined to be my friend.
And how did he express that?
He kept coming. The first time he came around, he was soaking wet, and it hadn't really rained. It never rains really very hard here. This is a high altitude desert. It doesn't rain very hard, and the raindrops are really far apart and very sparse. That means that only really, really large people get wet. If you're small and fast, you can kind of dodge the raindrops. And he was soaked. It looked like somebody had dunked him in the creek. Then you feel sorry for him and think maybe some dogs. There's not generally dogs running loose here. It's a very rare occasion. But I figured maybe dogs had run him into a creek or something. He was looking very forlorn, like he needed me. But I heard a knock on the door before I opened the door to see him out there all wet. And when I opened the door, there was nobody outside except him, too far away from the door to actually have knocked on it himself. And he looked down my driveway as though somebody had knocked and then ran down the driveway. So I looked down the driveway, but there was nobody there. And I walked all the way around the house. There was nobody around anywhere. Now, in those days, before the properties around here started getting built up, there was nobody here at all. There was, it would be really easy for me to see if there was a car within a mile. So there was nothing, no person. And he kept looking down the driveway as though it was somebody else. I later realized it was him. And he had a habit of knocking a rock against the door and making that knock, knock sound. So he must have done it the first day that I heard the knock also. After that, we got together because I was playing with a fly, big, big house fly that had landed on a scab on my knee. And I was being entertained by it. Well, I was first trying to get it off my knee by blowing on it, and that didn't work. The fly was just taking these reconnaissance laps and then landing on my scab again. So I started just letting the fly entertain me as it was just dancing in the blood on my knee. When I looked up, the fox was only an arm's length away from me, and he was staring at that same fly. It seemed like he didn't even realize I was there. He was just obsessed with the fly on my knee. And I called out to him, just saying, "Fox." At some point, he looked up, and then he put his nose down so that we were eye to eye, our eyes the same height, the same width. It was really me. I was sitting, so that made our eyes, and I'm small, the same width and the same height. And we just looked eye to eye, and I just said, "Fox." And he just kept looking at me. And once you lock eyes like that, he has you. I mean, anybody would have you, right? I mean, it's so unusual to be eye to eye with another individual whose eyes are so kind and wanting and alluring. And then snap, you're there. And you can try all you want to fight this relationship, but you are on this path to being, to having a relationship with a fox. In my case, a very close friendship with the fox. And there was no way out after that.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Catherine Raven about her wonderful book, Fox and I, An Uncommon Friendship. I was so struck by the intimacy of that relationship. And one of the happenings that really brought that home to me was when you replanted a small cactus next to your steps in a place where he was used to sitting and, in fact, lying down and resting. How did he let you know that that was not a good idea?
And so after this, you really know that he has me, right? I mean, I'm just totally gardening for him. Well, he came by and I wasn't on the front steps. I was in the front of the property working on some hedgerows, and I saw him stop, and he put his little nail, just, you know, his hand, just paw, just right on that little ball cactus, and he was pulling on it, and he turned to stare at me. And there was, I looked at him, and he wanted to make sure that I was looking at him, and he knew that I was. And once we were face to face for what seemed like way too long, there was no doubt that he knew that I knew that he had seen that cactus. And then he left. He just went right down the driveway, and he didn't show up for his regular 4:15 meeting, the rendezvous that he never missed. I couldn't believe it. I mean, he just didn't show up, and I couldn't sleep that night, and we had a snowstorm. So I threw on a robe, and in the snowstorm, in the dark, I went outside, and I was so worried about him not coming back anymore, because I had put that little teeny, it was like, it's a ball cactus. It's only like an inch. He could easily have, it wasn't anything that was intruding on his space, but he didn't want it there. So I dug up the cactus, and he came back the next day and sat in the spot where that little tiny cactus had been dug up. And I realized that he was the boss, and it was going to be that way. He didn't like change, and he didn't like that cactus there.
Yeah. You know, you figured out at a certain point that Fox was not habituated to people in general, but only to you. Why do you think he chose you to be his friend?
Well, one reason why I know it was me and not other people. The other people that I saw him run away from were not people that lived here, but people that would come by occasionally. My neighbor that was by one time, a couple people cutting across the property on foot, a car coming down the gravel road. But he ran. Oh, and actually my friend who came to visit from Canada. Yeah, so he ran from people. He did not like to be close to people at all. You know, I don't own a dog or a cat. I think that makes a difference. I doubt he would have wanted to be around me if I owned a dog or a cat. I was outside all the time. And because I was outside all the time and working on those weeds, he knew that, I mean, that mattered to him, the fact that he could have a shot at taming me into his regular schedule because I was always outside. He saw my big tools that I used and figured that I was a very useful friend. And the weeding that I was doing was very important to him because underneath these weeds, they're tall, relatively tall, a couple feet or so, even some were taller than that, woody and spiky, and underneath voles, so many voles. There were so many voles that while I was working on the weeds, one of them stopped on my leather boot toe and she gave birth. She popped two little volings out on my boot. I don't really think there was any other space. There was just my feet and voles and plants. They were so thick, so many voles. They were out all day long. There was almost not 5 minutes that you would look in the patch where you wouldn't see a vole coming by. But Fox couldn't eat them. And they're his favorite food. He couldn't eat them because the weeds were woody and spiky, and he couldn't jump through that. I mean, he's not going to jump through a bunch of spiky weeds. And snakes, of course, couldn't get into them, and birds couldn't get into them. So the voles just kept proliferating and proliferating in this huge weed patch. I hadn't realized that was what was happening. So he was excited about me getting rid of those weeds. And he started hanging out on the edge of the weed patch as I would work during the day. And voles would sometimes escape when they would hear my shovel, or maybe they felt the vibrations of the shovel. They would sometimes escape and he would be able to snatch them up. So he was very interested in how useful I was. He could certainly see that. I think that he sensed something else about me, and I can't say what that is, but I'm not sure there's very many other people in this valley that would have been sitting outside staring at a fly, dancing on their knee and twirling blood around like it was some kind of a scarf. And the fact that we both enjoyed that was something that we had in common. Later, we found out that we both liked walking in the moonlight, and we found out that we both like lollygagging in the sun. So that was a lot that we had in common. And I think that's probably enough for a friendship, isn't it?
This brings up a question. You struggled with the whole question of anthropomorphizing. You know, this is, and I think you went pretty far down the road. I mean, there are sections of the book in which you actually speak from Fox's point of view, which I wanted to ask you about. But before you answer that question, it's like, how did you get into the head of Fox? How did you overcome or reconcile or negotiate, I'd say, that boundary between objectivity and empathy? You know, that, I mean, anthropomorphizing, I think, really does have something to do with empathy. So that's kind of a whole ball of questions. Maybe you can untangle it.
I think that empathy for animals is something that comes natural to some people, and it does come natural to me. So it was easy for me to empathize with the fox once I took some of my cultural constraints out of my mind and started to just relax with the fox. That was so easy for me. But anybody can be more empathetic. You just have to try if it's not something that comes natural to you. I work hard at becoming more empathetic towards humans, and so people can become more empathetic towards animals, non-human animals. And of course, I know that everybody listening to the show realizes that humans are animals in the sense that we belong to the animal kingdom. But when we're talking colloquially like this, we don't bother to stop and say non-human animals and human animals, because it gets very clunky. So here in this program, we're just saying animals, we mean non-human animals. And I do think that empathy for non-human animals is very important. Empathy towards animals is very unusual, and you have to work hard at it. But I think it's worth it because it will expand your world so much, your understanding of the world, and also your enjoyment of the world. I think a lot of you maybe are letting relationships slip through your fingers because you're thinking that deer that's looking at you for a split second too long, you're thinking, no, it doesn't really know. It's just a deer, but maybe it's not. And maybe you're passing up the chance of having a relationship because you're not allowing your human nature to come forward. And I think human nature is telling you that you want to have friendships with animals. I think our culture might be telling us not to, but our human nature, which runs for many hundreds of thousands of years older than our culture, is telling us that we should have relationships with other animals.
Well, I mean, absolutely. And I think this is very much at the crux of this book, because as you read your amazing descriptions of not just fox, but all the other animals that live around your property, the magpies and others, one understands that, I mean, these animals are planning, they're using tools. I mean, magpies are impaling voles on fence barbs. And there is not, after all, and I think we're finding this out more and more in science, there's not, after all, that much that separates us from animals. You had one of your students who was shocked by this idea, who said, humans are not animals. And I thought, yes, to myself when I read, well, what do they think we are? Where did our feelings come from? Where did our emotions come from? You know, it's almost kind of like creationism. Obviously, we've been evolving these emotions, feelings, plannings, you know, our brains through the animal kingdom for millions of years.
Well, I want to remind you, however, it's so easy to see why people would think that, because Neanderthals are the same genus as us. And every day in the paper now, we're getting a little bit more information about Neanderthals. But at the time that I was teaching, and when this book takes place, not too many years ago, people just couldn't even imagine that Neanderthals were that closely. I mean, they treated Neanderthals as if they put Neanderthals with the rest of the animals, the non-human animals. And they are Homo Neanderthals, and we are Homo sapiens. So we are very closely related. And of course, now we realize that we mated, that we bred Homo sapiens and Homo Neanderthals. So when I tried to figure out why, it doesn't make any sense that people think that a human and a fox would be so different. And then I thought, well, they think a human and a Neanderthal is so different. So certainly they're not going to accept that a human and a fox could be very much alike.
Catherine Raven, this book, Fox and I, An Uncommon Friendship, so much turns around not just our commonality with the other animals, but our need to steward them. I mean, if we are Homo sapiens, I think we are that for a reason, and that reason is to take care of the other, since, and we seem to be doing, of course, quite the opposite. I wanted to ask you about that because it seemed to me that in your book, everything is connected, and you steward that land from an awareness of the tiniest insect, you know, to the voles, to fox, to magpie, to the weeds, the so-called weeds. You are thinking about all of it as a whole, and I'd like you to share that sensibility with us.
Well, I want to remind people that that connection that you're talking about in my book, the fact that everything is related, there's one word that refers to that, and that is nature. People have gotten in the habit of using the expression Mother Nature as though nature was this one individual that's up above us and ready to scold us all the time. Nature is a community. That's very important. And I hope you'll get through this book and you'll live inside the community as you're reading the book, and you'll come to the realization that you're reading about nature. Nature's a community of things, including plants and animals and clouds, and you belong to it. It's not something for you to visit. It's not something for you to stare at from a distance and hold in awe. You are part of that community, whether you like it or not, because you're born into the community. And so that's your place. And also our responsibility, you're born into it, so you can't escape your responsibility either. This is your community, nature.
Finally, there were several times in the book when you thought that Fox had died and you went through intense grief. That question of grief, you alluded to it also in the beginning, the ephemerality of the rainbow, the short life of a fox. Talk about balancing the joy of friendship with the impossibility of avoiding grief.
Absolutely. It is impossible and it is worthwhile. I live so closely with a sense of geologic time. I sit on boulders that are 40 million years old. I sit on a big boulder on my property that I talk about that's probably 2 billion, the mother rock of the earth. It was here when the earth was founded, this large boulder, which is this gorgeous, gorgeous rock. Not very many places in the world can you find rock that's this old. My sense of geology is influenced by the fact that I live with things that are so old. And that sense of geology then becomes my sense of time. So for me, whether something lives for a year or 4 years or 40 years, it's all just the same. It's just a blink of an eye. And that is something, a feeling that I get from being more in touch with my wild side, which I hope people will become more in touch with. And reading the book, you won't just feel like animals are more closer to humans than you previously thought, but you'll read the book and believe that humans are more closely related to animals. So you'll become more wild as they become more human in your eyes. And I think your sense of time will be altered by that. And when your sense of time is altered, you'll understand that it's worth it because there is no amount of time that's long enough on this planet for us. We're all of us only here just for a blink of an eye.
So on a final note, Catherine Raven, you and Fox, you say, have very different personalities. He's gregarious. You're a loner. Yet you also say that you became more like Fox. How did you become more like Fox?
I became more like the Fox one way. I stopped trying to hide and disappear from the world, being a person with really no self-esteem whatsoever, and realizing that he went out and made friends, that he put himself in very dangerous situations to be physically close to me, a human with tools. He did it because he thought it was worth the risk to have a friend, because he realized that living alone is not a very good idea. That was very important for me to come out into the world. And also I realized that there's a big difference between a structure and a home. And I had always thought of myself, everybody has the one thing that they mostly identify themselves with. And it's probably something that you don't tell the world. When you tell the world who you are, you tell them your name and where you live and what kind of degrees you have and if you've written anything and if you have kids and if you're married, those kind of things you use to identify yourself. Maybe some of your important political associations, but we have something really personal that's on our mind that we always feel like, this is who I am. I'm the shy kid, or I'm the awkward kid, or I'm the bully bossy guy. To me, it was always a person that didn't have a home. That was always on my mind. And yet I realized from the Fox, so there's a structure and a home, and the home you make yourself. That's it. You don't just wait around for someone to offer you one. And I decided to feel comfortable here, to make this land my home, to make this place my home. And it travels with you wherever you are, and it gives you this sense of peace. And it also helps your self-esteem, because now you have something behind you, this community, this place, and you're rooted. And it gives you an entirely different opinion of yourself.
And on those wise words, I want to thank you, Catherine Raven, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice, and even more than that, for writing this stunning book. You have a unique perspective and a way of entering into the Newman, the spirit of a place that really captures one's attention. Thank you.
Thank you, and see you soon. Bye-bye.
Catherine Raven. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.